Hello and welcome to the As Hitler Named London Theatre Podcast for the 2nd of October 2016. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Unfaithful, which is on at the Found 111 space, which is in the old St Martin's School in Charing Cross Road. Unfaithful, a 2013 play, which was first staged at the Edinburgh Fringe, and this is the London premiere of it. It's directed by Adam Penfold and stars Sean Campion, Niamh Cusack, Ruta Gamintas, and Matthew Lewis. Owen McCafferty has done a number of plays in London, including a play at the National Theatre called Scenes from the Big Picture, and an adaptation of Days of Wine and Roses, taking the story of an alcoholic couple and setting it in Ireland. In Unfaithful, we have the story of two couples whose lives become intertwined. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, thanks, Tim. Yes, I think it's a bit of a date movie. It's a date play, really, for those of a certain age, because I think one of the things that struck me after seeing this piece, and it's been running for some time, I think it opened either late August or very early September, and it runs through until the 8th of October at Found 1-1. But one of the things that struck me about this piece is that it's very much a middle-aged person's sex fantasy, and not quite being of that age. It was something to enjoy with clinical detachment, I think, more than anything else. Because, you know, there's 50-something couple, Tom and Joan, who feel like it's too late to do anything else. So they're stuck with each other. And it actually kind of feels like they've opened up this game that they want to play, where one confesses that they've had a sexual relationship with a younger other person. So it starts off with Tom confessing he's had a sexual relationship with a younger woman. Then Joan goes about and seeks revenge by hiring a male escort. Now, of course, being a play and being a four-hander, there has to be some sort of relationship between all the characters. And it turns out that the married couple end up having sex with a younger couple, but not knowing that. So Tom gets picked up at a bar by a woman who just so happens to be partnered or dating a male escort. And when Joan goes and seeks her revenge by hiring the escort, it's naturally, this is the guy that is picked up. The thing about this piece, though, is it feels like all the best lines and all the best scenes are with the older couple, and that Matthew Lewis and as Peter and Ruta Gamintas as Tara, just sort of the fresh meat in the piece. And that's not to say that it isn't enjoyable, and it's not to say that everyone delivers a terrific performance. I think one of the exciting things about Found 111 is that this pop-up theatre has managed to create such events out of the performances that they present and the productions that they present. They certainly, of the ones I've seen, you certainly won't forget them in a hurry. And it's quite evocative and atmospheric, the place. And I think the other benefit about this piece too is that it's actually not terribly long. So I think it's 75 minutes straight through. You do kind of feel that perhaps if it was a longer piece, it may have worn out its welcome. So it keeps things brisk and breezy and quite funny for the time that it is. But I think the other thing to say is that, you know, Sean Campion as Tom, the 50-something or 60-something man in the piece, and Niamh Cusack as his wife, just, you know, are absolutely hilarious to actually watch as they talk dirty and about eating this out and screwing that, or using a lot more harsher words than that. And I think for anyone of a certain age, I think it would be a hilarious night out and possibly someone's idea of a sex fantasy. I think the other thing about this piece is that it's quite a slick production in a fairly tight space of this pop-up theatre at Found 111. And credit goes to Richard Kent, who seems to make quite a lot out of sliding mirrors and a single bed that gets moved about to do all sorts of things and tell the story of both a hotel room, a bedroom, marital bedroom, a bar, and all sorts of other things. So I thought it was quite a lot of fun. And while it may not be entirely credible and entirely plausible, well worth checking out. Oh, and one other thing. Obviously, Matthew Lewis does get his shirt off. but he's not the buff character that he has been in some of other films and stage shows. So it may be a disappointment for some, but it's probably worth mentioning that as well.
Yeah, he's just about to do the full Monty, isn't he?
Yes, so he's probably on way to doing the usual, you know, protein shakes and heavy-duty workout to do that. Although, actually, in the full Monty, they're not meant to be particularly fit, are they? They're meant to be more, you know, average Joes, and that's part of the charm of the whole piece, isn't it? So you may still see the same Matthew Lewis that you see, but just not when you Google Matthew Lewis in photos. He has got various body shapes. Here he's looking more like the average Joe, because that's what he's meant to be.
I'm not sure about the place of being on Found 111. I think we mentioned before when we talked about plays here that they have, as you said, put on some interesting stuff and got a lot of good people in, but it really isn't a suitable place for the theatre. You have a whole lot of stairs to go up, then go through a number of darkened rooms, then up a whole load of other stairs, and when you get there, it's these uncomfortable chairs and there are pillars in the wrong place. It has to be said, though, as you did, the traverse staging in this play rids us of the sightline problems, and I barely notice the pillars. The theatre space is also not air-conditioned, so it has been cold on one or two occasions, and I went to this play on the hottest night of the year, and it was a very, very sweaty time for everybody, which meant we were quite glad that it was only 75 minutes straight through. The play isn't too long, it certainly didn't wear out its welcome, and it was funny, and you did feel that you were getting into the life of a middle-aged couple. Although, having said that, maybe we didn't get enough into the lives of the younger couple, especially Tara, played by Ruta Gemintas. She is a little bit underwritten, I felt, and yeah, we just felt I needed to know a lot more about her, and a lot more about her relationship with her boyfriend. And they actually have scenes together, so it is, you know, it's not her or Matthew Lewis. It is the writing, really. I also didn't think that Niamh Cusack and John Campion were playing games, although you could easily see that they were kind of playing games right at the end of the play. That's what their relationship comes into, and it's very much born out of the fact that Sean Campion is bored to begin with and thinks that their marriage is stale and boring and thinks he needs to put something into it. And it's notable that by the end of this experience, they've lied to each other. He's told one for something he didn't do, and she's telling a lie about something that she probably did. It certainly seems that she did. It is a well-put-together play, Night at Found 111, but this place really isn't a theatre space unless you use it as one of those exploratory promenade pieces. That, of course, is how the space was found in the first place. I'm now going to talk about The Dover Road at the German Street Theatre. This is a play from 1921 by A.A. Milne. It's directed by Nicola McAuliffe. And it's directed by Nicola McAuliffe. The inevitable first thing to say about this play is that A.A. Milne went on to create Winnie the Pooh. All the reviewers have mentioned it. They don't necessarily, though, mention that he was a regular contributor and one-time assistant editor of Punch, and in case you're wondering, Punch was a humorous magazine with the reputation that it had never been as good or as funny as it used to be. As a playwright, Milne is probably best known for Toad of Toad Hall, which for many years was a standard adaptation of Wind in the Willows until everyone started using the one written by Alan Bennett. This play opens with a couple, Leonard and Anne, played by Tom Durant Pritchard and Georgia Maguire, on their way to an adulterous time on the French Riviera. Leonard, who is a lord of some description, is already married, and Anne is keen to escape from her domineering father. Unfortunately, because of car problems, they end up arriving at what might just be a hotel off the Dover Road. They are assured by a butler type, played by Stefan Bernard Six, that although it looks suspiciously like a large country house, it is a sort of hotel. It is, in fact, a house, the house of a Mr. Latimer, played by Patrick Reichardt, and it appears that he and his staff know all about their elopement. Leonard's new chauffeur has been bribed to bring him here without any luggage. It becomes clear that the couple are trapped here and are politely forced to spend almost all their time together for a week, not all their time, of course, because we're in 1921 and the Lord Chamberlain mustn't be upset. Mr. Latimer's idea is that spending so much time together in one another's company will cure the couple of their infatuation. He helps their potential breakup along by ensuring that Leonard catches cold. Leonard reacts badly, and Anne begins to see his flaws. This is not Mr. Latimer's first attempt at couples therapy. In fact, there is another couple at the house. They happen to be Leonard's wife Eustasia and her lover Nicholas, played by Katrina Gibson and James Sheldon. Nicholas has had the cold treatment and is suffering from Eustasia's overcloying ministrations. The couples meet, and there is quite a lot of fun in a vein reminiscent of P.G. Wodehouse. We also get some prefiguring of Coward's private lives, which is understanding but not necessarily approval of adultery. And although there seems to be a growing attraction between the non-married halves of the couples, Anne and Nicholas, it is actually the chaps who bond best and run off to the Riviera together, without, of course, worrying the Lord Chamberlain. Perhaps the most touching part of the play is the growing bond between Georgia Maguire's Anne and Patrick Reichardt's slightly dippy and rumpled Mr. Latimer. After one encounter between them with of some romantic promise, Mr. Latimer turns to his butler and asks, "How old am I?" To which the reply is, "Too old for that." As well as playing the butler, Stefan Bernardczyk plays the piano and sings what I'm told is a reworded version of Noel Coward's standard Forbidden Fruit. He also has quite a gift for Mozart, which he plays quite a lot of. I've seen a few things before, including a Kevin Hood play called Sugar Hill Blues from more than a quarter of a century ago. There was an odd innovation in the staging of this play, which doesn't appear to be in the stage directions, and hasn't actually been mentioned by any of the viewers, as far as I can see. According to the script, Mr. Latimer just enters the room, but in this production, the lighting briefly falls, and a painting on the and a man, dressed like an 18th century gent walking along the side of a road, disappears from a painting on the wall. As the lights come back on, a dazed Mr. Latimer is on a couch, looking as if he's just been thrown there. At the end of the play, just as they are expecting another couple to arrive mistakenly at the house, there is another lighting failure, and Mr. Latimer disappears, and the walking man is back in the painting. I was intrigued to see this touch of the supernatural, and wasn't sure until I checked whether it was in the script. It is possible that Nicola McAuliffe wanted to suggest Mr. Latimer is some kind of good angel or mischievous spirit, testing relationships for their strength or to their breaking point. I couldn't help thinking of Nicola McAuliffe's own 2011 play, A British Subject, where she played herself and revealed her very strong Catholic beliefs. She was forever praying in that play This change to the play was somehow fitting, and perhaps it echoed the rise in spiritualism and spirituality that happened during and after the First World War, which of course is when this is set. All in all, this play was a charming and fun discovery, and certainly made me wonder about some of the other plays by A. Milne. I'm now going to talk about Father Comes Home from the Wars, Parts 1, 2 and 3 at the Royal Court Theatre. This is Pulitzer Prize winner Susan Laurie Park's trilogy of three short plays, intended as the first three parts of a 9-play cycle. This has led to obvious parallels with August Wilson's 20th Century Cycle, which a lot of people have mentioned in the reviews. Although, I have to say, given its setting, it resonated more for me as an African-American family history, like perhaps Alex Haley's Roots. This play is directed by Joe Bonney, who directed the premiere of it at the Public Theatre in New York in 2014. I think the only other Susan Laurie Park's play I've seen was a play called Top Dog Underdog at the Royal Court back in 2003. That one had quite an interesting cast. It starred Mos Def and Jeffrey Wright, and had Jeffrey Wright whiting up as he played a strange version of Abraham Lincoln. It was a rather odd play, it has to be said. Father Comes Home from the Wars stars Jimmy Akinbola, Tom Bateman, Dex Lee, Sabucio Mamba, Nadine Marshall, Sarah Niles, Jason Pennicook, John Stahl, Steve Toisson, and Leo Ringer. In the first part of this play, called Measure for Man, the leading character, a slave called Hero, played by Steve Toisson, is hanging out near his shack and is faced with a difficult decision. It's 1862, and his master, a colonel in the Confederate Army, wishes Hero to leave his Texas plantation and accompany him to the war. Hero is promised freedom if he joins his master in the fighting, and if he doesn't go, he might be punished and may even be sold on to a crueler master. Hero's adopted father, played by Leo Ringer in a rather magnificent beard, he is supposed to be the oldest slave alive, wants Hero to go to the war, while Hero's wife Penny, played by Nadine Marshall, wants him to stay. Other slaves on the plantation bet on what he might do. One of the other slaves, though, Homer, played by Jimmy Akinbola, thinks neither choice makes much difference, as Hero will always be the victim of the whims of his owner. Homer has more reason than most for his cynicism, as the master had Hero hobble him after Homer tried to run away. It's very clear from the start of this play that Susan Laurie Parks is taking inspiration from ancient Greek plays and myths. The other slaves are often chorus-like, and names like Homer and Penny are perhaps to remind us of Odysseus's reluctance to head off to the Trojan War. In the second part, called A Battle in the Wilderness, Hero is guarding a Union officer, played by Tom Bateman, and is bullied by his master, the colonel, played by John Stahl. It's a very taut three-hander, with Hero being tempted to help the Union soldier, but somehow unable to break away from his master. In one section, Hero points out that he often escapes a beating by white strangers because he can say who his master is. What will protect him if he says that he belongs to himself? The third part of the play is called The Union of My Confederate Parts, and is possibly the most ancient Greek in style, with a group of passing runaway slaves acting as a chorus, and a plot that has elements of the Odyssey, Agamemnon's return, and perhaps even Medea. It also has an actor playing Hero's loyal talking dog, Odyssey, played by Dex Lee, who has tracked his master to the wars and back again. If you know your Odyssey, you'll know that it is Odysseus's old dog who first recognizes its master when Odysseus finally returns to Ithaca. It's a part played for humour, but also is, I thought, a rather good imagining of how a dog might see the world. Hero, now calling himself Ulysses, after both General Grant and, of course, the Romanized version of Odysseus, returns, still wearing his Confederate uniform, although he wears a Union soldier's shirt underneath to show that he's perhaps on both sides. Penelope has waited for him, but has reached out in her loneliness to Homer and is pregnant. She fears what Hero might do when he finds out. But Hero has brought his own new wife back from the war, and somehow thinks that they can, sort of, all three of them can live together quite happily. In the end, we don't quite get the Orisaria ending that we might expect, and the chorus certainly expect something like that to happen, something, you know, lots of nets and people being stabbed to death. We do get a fight between Hero and Homer, but we don't get anything really vicious and violent and, well, Greek. There are a number of impressive performances here. Steve Toisson as Hero, managing to look the hero physically, but in many ways still being weak. Nadine Marshall, she's a favourite actress of mine, and the only complaint I'd always have is I'd always like to see a lot more of her in anything she does. I was also, as I often am, impressed by John Stahl as a skilled bully, who seems weak and venal, but is still able to dominate a man he sees as his property. The play is perhaps a little overlong, overstuffed with historical facts and heavy-handed with its modern parallels, but I thought it's quite successful in the end. And I really would like to see the other parts once Susan Laurie Parks has written them.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.